I believe, a personal responsibility to make the time and invest in taking responsibility of your stuff so that you don't work your stuff out on other people. This is a really vulnerable, intimate relationship that's weirdly one-sided, that's nothing like any other relationship you've ever had. And if it's not right, it doesn't work. And yes, there are tears, but actually there's a lot of giggles and there's a lot of camaraderie and humour, and it's not all doom and gloom. When you hear counsel or therapy, in comes the stigma, the taboo. People almost think that you either have to be in crisis or you have to be at a place where you're contemplating whether you want to live or not to warrant therapy. Mm-hmm. And actually, what we'd rather it be, that it is a resource that you can lean on when you recognise something's not right, but you're not yet in crisis.
Hello, I'm Tiffany Jathawan, and this is the Myself Included podcast, the show about turning taboo topics into the bread and butter of our daily conversations. It's been a while, but we're back and we're tackling one hell of a taboo. I'll let you in on a little secret. This guest has been on my guest wish list since day dot. I wasn't quite sure if, how, or when we'd make this happen, but I've always wanted it to happen. This might seem as quite a disruptive episode by some, but I feel like even if it is, it'll be for all the right reasons. I often toy with who should guest appear on the podcast or something I've said. Then I bring it back to the purpose of the podcast, which is to tackle taboo topics. Yes, this is likely the most vulnerable both the guests and I've ever been, but that's what makes it so right and relevant. Enough teasing you now. My next guest is Charlotte Braithwaite, and Charlotte is my therapist. If you've listened to the podcast for some time, you would have heard me speak about her and refer to her as gold dust, and that she is. With this next guest, the roles have reversed. Instead of me being in the client chair answering the questions, she's in the guest chair being asked the questions by me. At the beginning, Charlotte highlights that ethically, we have both agreed to participate in this way for the purpose of the podcast, that these episodes are not therapy themselves, but rather a dose of therapy real talk. In this next episode, Charlotte and I talk about her career background before becoming a counsellor, how she sat in the client's chair herself before becoming a psychotherapist, the common themes as to why people seek professional support, common myths about therapy, and the rest, well, you'll have to listen to the episode to find out. You'll also hear us towards the end having some technical issues, which I decided to leave in, partly so that it makes sense, but also, shit happens. Charlotte and I cover a lot of grounds, which warrants two parts this episode. Part one is more about her journey, part two is more about mine, mixed in with some advice, analogies, and a whole lot more. Wherever you are, and however you are listening to this episode, I hope it's both enlightening and comforting. Without further ado, this is me and my therapist.
Hello, good morning.
Good morning.
Firstly, thank you very much for giving up your time today. I'm very grateful to have you on the show. I must say, I feel a bit alien. This is a bit alien to me as the roles are reversed. Usually I'm the one who's talking. Well, that's often the case. And you're the one asking the questions, but not today.
No. No. And actually, I'm sort of sat here feeling quite vulnerable. For context, as a therapist, it just feels really important to say that this podcast isn't the therapy session. Whilst what we're hopefully going to do is kind of have a bit of a therapy real talk is certainly how I want to approach it. But yes, the fact that we are connected, but we've had a conversation beforehand about how this is going to work and that I'm in the hot seat for a change, which I am comfortably uncomfortable with.
That's a good way of putting it. So I wanted to begin with how we both connected, as you just said, but before that, given our working relationship, you as a therapist and me as the client, I think it makes sense to explore your background and how and why you became a therapist. So that being said, could you give us a glimpse into what life looked like before you had a career in counselling?
So not to make it sort of a this is your life type story. Ultimately, I was in marketing. So we have a commonality. I was in marketing. I did very well in marketing, but I got really burnt out. And part of that burnout was a mixture of professional stress, but also no personal past traumas that caught up with me ultimately. And so I had what Brené Brown would call a spiritual awakening. Mine definitely looked like a breakdown. And I was sort of taken a bit like a dog to the vets, to a therapist, by my parents, who were understandably a bit despairing. And I went to therapy quite apprehensive, a bit resentful, not really expecting much. And 3 years later, decided that this was the best thing ever. My life dramatically changed as a result. I found the courage to make some really brave decisions that I don't think I would have made without that support. And I also realized that I wasn't a massive fan of marketing. And I remember sitting with my therapist at the time saying I felt quite uninspired, and it wasn't just about the burnout. Actually, I'd fallen into this as a career. And I said, actually, what I really want to do is do what you do. And how do I become a therapist? My therapist told me where she trained. And without doing any research, I went to the exact same place she trained, signed up to a course, and decided that this was what I was going to do. So my sort of pre-story is of one sitting in the client chair. And actually, a lot of therapists, I think it's like 70% in the governing body that I belong to of their data, start in the client chair. I think that the term wounded healer comes to mind. And it's something that I feel really quite, I think it sits within my integrity that I know what it's like to sit in the other chair. I know it's not easy, and that I really admire anybody who can be brave enough, because it's a big thing to step into the chair and sit there and be terrified, but know that you have to do something about it. So that's the short story.
I didn't realize it was your parents that took you. It's good that you kind of could turn to them through that time.
I wouldn't say turn to, but I would say, you know, I was a young adult who thought I knew better, but didn't. I didn't feel like I had a choice, but I certainly am incredibly grateful that even though I wasn't necessarily willing, they stepped in. I needed somebody to step in at that point.
Yeah, I'm sure they had sort of your best interests at heart, as they say. And yeah, I think a lot of people don't necessarily assume that the therapist has been in that other chair themselves. But as you say, I wouldn't be surprised if that was usually the case, that others have been through. We've all been through something. We've all had our own shit, as they say. So yeah, I can imagine that being the case. So following on from how we connected, if I recall rightly, perhaps targeted isn't the right word, but you found me on Instagram as you're a fellow marketer yourself. And I think it's important to kind of find the right therapist. And one of the decision makers for choosing you, though, kind of early in your career, was that there are similarities between us both, from the age range to the career background and so on. Is it just as important for you to find the right client that you would like to work with?
Absolutely. I think this is, without getting excited and going back into marketing speak, because though I proclaimed just now that I didn't enjoy marketing, I think it was more that I didn't necessarily enjoy the product that I was marketing at the time. And yes, targeted feels a little bit of a strong word. but yes, I think, you know, for me, early in my career, a bit like, you know, when all of us start out in a new career, we perhaps work with people that we don't necessarily align with, or we find ourselves in situations that we've been quite naive to. And certainly, when you go through therapeutic training, you have to do a certain number of clinical hours under very heavy supervision to prove that you are qualified and equipped. But you don't get a choice of who you see. I worked for a charity. So I worked with all different people from all different backgrounds, which is great exposure. But there is definitely, like, we align with certain people in our lives and we just click with some people. We might not click with everybody. As a therapist, how I work is going to work with certain clients, and how I work is not going to work with certain clients. And it makes a huge difference. If the person in the room likes you, works well with you, you know, some people just want to sit, have space, and just talk, and that's what they need. I'm definitely more of a therapist coach in my approach. for me, it's not just about talking about your feelings. It's about, okay, well, what does this mean for your life? And is there change required? And what can you do about that? What do you want to do? What do you not want to do? And some people don't like that. So I think of, as I've developed as a therapist and found out more who I am and different types of therapy too, because like I said to you just now, when I first started training to be a therapist, I didn't know research. It was a really impulsive decision. It was just, I know I want to do this. And what I found was the type of therapy that I first studied was not aligned with who I am. And that I then managed to find a type of therapy that does, and that works much, well, you know, much better for me. And funnily enough, the type of clients that now gravitate towards me, or I gravitate towards, are aligned with how I talk or my values. That it's not necessarily that I can only work with people whom I like, but there has to be a resonance, because otherwise it doesn't work. Yeah, this is a really vulnerable, intimate relationship that's weirdly one-sided, that's nothing like any other relationship you've ever had. And if it's not right, it doesn't work fundamentally.
Yeah, I think you need to have that gel between you, don't you? I don't know. I often sometimes wonder if I had, say, you know, slightly older therapist or a male therapist, what that would have looked like. But obviously, yeah, that sort of gel between you is important. I think in business, you can, over the years, afford to kind of be a bit more picky, because like you say, you look for something more aligned with your values, and then you kind of get word of mouth sort of marketing, going back to marketing again. But yeah, I think that's all important as well.
You know, it is worth saying, there is an asterisk to that. There's always an and. Mm-hmm. Because I remember in my therapeutic training, because if you do good quality training, they will always require you to be in therapy whilst you're in your training. Because one of my therapists actually said to me, you can only take your clients as far as you have been. So a bit like you said, you know, actually, you wouldn't get on a plane with a pilot who'd never sat as a passenger.
Yeah.
So as a therapist, you know, it's a matter of integrity that, you know, I've sat in the chair too. But I remember being really resistant. I never wanted to see a male therapist. Now, that's to do with my stuff, my history, and that I, in my training, I think it was my second year of training, there was only one male therapist that I could see. And I went there, again, there's a theme here, apprehensive, slightly resentful, even though I was, you know, really sold on therapy at that point. And I was really surprised, because I could be somebody different with that thing.
Yeah.
And actually, I found myself being a lot more straight talking and a lot more direct than I would be with a female therapist, or had been with a female therapist. And that what I realized was that there was something about, I didn't need to necessarily talk niceties that were part of my people pleaser part that I would play out with women. Yeah. That I was like, well, he's a man. He's a straight talker, projected all of that on him, and just was actually far more honest.
Yeah.
So even though we talk about the right therapist, it doesn't mean that you have to have warm, fuzzy feelings. It's more about, do you feel safe enough with that person? I think that's, for me, the biggest part.
Yeah, it's interesting, because I prefer working with male managers, shall we say. But I thought maybe I wouldn't enjoy it as a therapist, but maybe that would surprise me, because like you say, I probably get on well with them because of the straight talking. So who knows? I should also say that when you found me on Instagram, I was obviously looking for a therapist already, and I guess it's all that algorithm and stuff. And then I did, yeah, obviously look out on your site and everything, which, although, yeah, you're sort of new to the industry, you know, there are sort of, like anything, tick box exercises, or sort of a bit like TripAdvisor and so on. There are certain accreditations and directories and that you can sort of check that the therapist is qualified. And like you said, I think a lot of professionalisms, they require to do X amount of hours of it first. So yeah, and it's very kind of modern way, I guess, of finding a therapist, but you can still do all the checks and like you say, see if it's a good gel between you both. And what do you find to be the most common reasons for people seeking support through a psychotherapist?
Gosh, okay, that's a big, it's a really big question. I mean, topic wise, we anything from bereavement, redundancy, relationship breakdown, identity crisis, friendship crisis, family dynamics, like that, though each person's story is unique, we all go through the same sorts of dilemmas. It's the paradox that we live in. From a broader perspective, if I sort of take it out of it, most of the time, if you boil it all down, it comes to a bit of an existential dilemma, which is about the person feels out of relationship with themselves. For one reason or another, they are disconnected from themselves or struggle to stay connected to themselves while staying connected to others, because they are required to disconnect from themselves in order to be in relationship with others. Sort of self-sacrifice, if you like, for the sake of attachment. And that, I think, relationships is the biggest thing. Relationships in the broadest sense. So if it's grief, it's to do with the loss of a relationship. If it's family dynamics, it's to do with your, you know, systemic relationships. If it's romantic, it's to do with your partner. It's, we are relational beings, and that includes the relationship with ourselves. So it's a broad question and a broad answer, unfortunately.
But relatable much. Yes. Okay. And I just sort of know there are many myths and outdated perceptions around the format of therapy. It's often assumed when someone goes to a therapy, they lie down on a couch and they delve deep into their childhood trauma. Could you give us an insight into your modern practice?
She says, sat in front of a couch. Yeah, no. And this made me smile because I too had that myth. I sort of, you know, like the movies, and where it's often depicted, they're on like a chaise lounge and the person sat behind them with a pen like Freud. And I remember when I first was taken to therapy, I went into my therapist's garden and they had a summer house. And I walked in and there was two wicker chairs. And I remember now like it being really quite over warm because there was a little portable heater. And though it was slightly uncomfortable with the heat and probably the anxiety that I was feeling that was permeating my body too, I thought this isn't what I thought it would be. And I liked how cozy it was. I liked that it was discreet. I liked that I wasn't walking into a GP practice or somewhere that said like counseling clinic. I liked that I wasn't going to bump into anybody that I knew. And so my introduction to therapy surprised me too. I was expecting, you know, someone to tell me to go lay down on a couch. And I, as you will know, I emulated that pretty much. You know, when I first set up practice, I had a summer house in the garden that had crystals and candles and plants. And it was really important to me to create an environment that was discreet, that was comfortable, that felt like it was a safe sanctuary. I then, as my practices developed, I moved house about 18 months ago and moved indoors, which is a big thing because I don't have to do spider checks anymore between every client. But I now have a sofa, and funny enough, some clients do come and sort of curl up and semi lay down, but it's more about comfort than it is expectation. I think the myth of you're going to be interrogated, I say the myth that I'm going to ask you what your childhood's like isn't really a myth, because we have to go there to understand who you are. The myth that everything is your mother's fault, again, like your mother plays a really big role, but you know, all your primary caregivers do, but it's not the soul aspect of life trauma. I think that also that therapy is really serious and I'm there to make you cry. I hear that a fair bit. And yes, there are tears, but actually there's a lot of giggles and there's a lot of camaraderie and humor, and it's not all doom and gloom. And I think that's, you know, actually, as well, what I hear, if I go to a dinner party, I get two reactions when when people say, oh, what do you do? I'm a therapist. One, they either then think, okay, I want to get some free therapy mm-hmm. and sort of overshare and spill, or tell me about, oh, I've got this friend. I've got a friend. Or they clam up and think that I'm psychoanalyzing them mm-hmm. and that I'm psychoanalyzing under the guise of compassion, but really it's judgment. And then I usually get the question, but don't you get really depressed listening to everybody's problems all day? And I don't. And it's not because I don't care. It's because a really massive part of training is teaching you how not to take on other people's stuff. And also, it's, yes, it can sometimes be sad. Yes, it can be hard, but the breakthroughs and the light bulb moments and the, I understand myself better, really lift somebody's sense of self. So I come out of my day sometimes feeling heavy because I'm like, gosh, you know, that's really tough and that person's really struggling. But most of the time, I want to high five them as they leave the room. I don't, because, you know, you're not meant to. There's some boundaries to be had, but you know, I want to air high five them because it's epiphanies mm-hmm. that they have, and that is not doom and gloom at all. That's really liberating for both people in the room.
Yeah, it's funny to say about the light bulb moments. So we've even got friends that go to therapy and often say to them, there'll be sessions where you think you're not going to cry and then you do, or vice versa, and the sessions where you think, did I take much from that? And actually, like, subconsciously, you took actually a lot more than you realized. And other times you walk away and think, God, that was an absolute golden nugget. So it can really kind of vary that you don't always know what to expect, but that's kind of part of it. And I think, yeah, sometimes you go in a bit like a day at work, prepared on what you're going to say and what you think you're going to cover. And then sometimes you delve deep in something completely different. And you just, I think it's good to sort of just run with it and kind of go with the flow as much as you can, because sometimes you don't realize that you needed to explore that because you had this list of things to cover. But yeah, each to their own as well, I guess. But you've had a couple of practices over the years, and I know that given that I'm likely one of your longest standing clients, and some might say that's not something I should be proud of. What are your thoughts on long-term support? If I'm able to access support on an ongoing basis, why not?
You know, it's perhaps I should have included this on the myth busting, because I think you know a good place to start is, and I know we've had conversations like this before, whereby if someone gets a personal trainer, they're like, oh yeah, good for you, yeah, I need to work out too, and you're taking care of your health. If someone gets even a personal coach, a little less practice perhaps in the UK, more of like an American thing, you know, everyone's got a life coach, everyone's got a shrink, but people are still encouraging. I think when you hear counselor or therapy, in comes the stigma, the taboo. People think almost think that you either have to be in crisis or you have to be at a place where you're contemplating whether you want to live or not to warrant therapy. Mm-hmm. And actually what we'd rather it be, that it is a resource that you can lean on when you recognize something's not right, but you're not yet in crisis. And therapy isn't, and I remember doing this too, Brené Brown, as we often fangirl over, you know, talks about herself where, you know, she went into therapy with a basic, like a six-point bullet list, and was like, right, okay, so how many sessions are we talking? Like 8 sessions, so we're gonna be cured. And what people don't appreciate, unless you've been in the chair, is that a bit of therapist talk here, but we said the presenting issue normally isn't the presenting issue. You may come in with, because you're struggling at work, but actually it's to do with grief, because everything's connected. And that's when, like you were saying just now, you might come in even to one session with an idea of what you want to talk about. And then I'm listening for something else, and then I ask you another question and we go down a completely different route, and then we think, oh, actually the things that I wanted to talk about weren't really the things I needed to talk about, or that they become more insignificant, or we circle back and we revisit them again. I think when it comes to long-term therapy. I practice open-ended. So for as long as it's beneficial, the client is welcome. And it's not just about mental illness, let's say, or like depression, anxiety, like the symptoms that are really debilitating. The way I work is this is about becoming the truest expression of your potential. So I don't want you to just not be depressed or just not be anxious, because number one, you're human, and those are human emotions that you will feel until you're physically not here. You know, anxiety is a normal function. We just don't want that to be your permanent state. That, you know, depression is sadness that doesn't know how to express itself or doesn't know how to understand itself. These are symptoms that actually, when we begin to understand them, we enter a journey that isn't short term. And it's, I believe, a personal responsibility to make the time and invest in taking responsibility of your stuff so that you don't work your stuff out on other people. I've rephrased that coin from Brené Brown. She says, stop working your shit out on other people. But we, you know, we, and that's unfortunately how we tend to work our stuff out, is by projecting it on others. And the great thing about a therapist is you can project on me all you like, and I will pick it up and go, huh, it's really interesting that, you know, you're experiencing me like that, because that's how, that's reminds me of when you said this, or wait, so why did you think I was angry? I wasn't angry at all. And then by mirroring it back, we enter a journey that isn't just resolvable. It's about self-awareness. And that's not a tick sheet thing. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that does make sense. And yeah, I couldn't agree more about taking the responsibility. I mean, whilst it was daunting to see a therapist, and I was quite like proud that I'd had the kind of balls to go and research and sort it. And like you say, I think you should take responsibility and not project onto others. So when you are brave enough to seek support and then you get challenged by the fact you are, you think, hang on a minute, like it took a lot to do that in the first place. And if anything, I'm taking responsibility for my own happiness. Because I think you're right, there is often roots to your childhood and to your parents. Obviously, there that comes a point where you're an adult yourself, and it's up to you to then decide how you sort of deal things going forward. And I think people often have that analogy, don't they, about a car MOT and service, and it's that kind of thing to kind of keep on top of your mental and your physical health. What else was I also thinking on that note? Oh yeah, and just of course that I think when people sort of think you go there, and it might be safe for a divorce or for redundancy, but then why would you be done with it if then, yeah, something else in the future comes along? So you might say have a divorce in your 30s, being run up redundant in your 40s, and you need to, you know, engage with support when that time comes. And I think for me, throughout my 20s, I've massively evolved, and it has kind of come more of a life coaching in a way, I think, our relationship towards the latter end of our time together. But I think it makes sense for me to keep going back, because there's more things I need to explore and resolve, if you know what I mean.
And also, it's the, as you grow, like life didn't just, like you sort of correctly pointed out, it's, yes, of course, our early years and our early attachments and relationships, they become the blueprint of how we then go out into the world. But that as you become an adult, it doesn't mean that then that's it. Like it's, then you're an adult and you just know how to do life, or you don't change, or you don't regress, or you don't go through other traumas. And for many of my clients, and yes, you are a longer standing client. You're actually not the longest standing client, just to take that title away. But I think what is a part of that is some people come, they do a season of therapy on a particular subject. They may then have a break. Something else might happen down the line. They might revisit. I have clients that come weekly. I have clients that come bi-weekly. And for people that I've worked with historically who it feels ethically okay to do and it's safe to do. People who then check in and we have more ad hoc sessions, it's very focused work together, because you don't need therapy in the same way. It's more about self-accountability, self-responsibility, having a safe space where you can figure something out that you're already kind of there with, but you just need somebody else to bounce ideas off of. And I think that's what you're saying, is it feels more coaching to some degree because you have evolved. You don't need therapy in the way that you perhaps felt you did, but it's something that you now realize the value of. And so the judgment from others is not about how you experience it. It's quite often because it can feel very uncomfortable for other people, because it's a mirror that they haven't necessarily dealt with some of their stuff, or what happens if you're talking about me? You know, all of those things, it makes other people feel uncomfortable because it is still a really taboo subject. I don't think it should be, but there is a cultural aspect of, you know, stiff upper lip in British culture, keep calm, carry on, that absolutely descends even now. Those sort of millennial Gen Z are, I believe, changing the landscape of mental health. It doesn't just change with one generation.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Sorry, can I just pause you there? I don't know if you can see this, but
I see the time thing.
Yeah, because it said I did an upgrade yesterday, but it's saying upgrade to Zoom Pro.
Yes, I've had to do that too.
What, is it free?
No. Oh. So basically, what I would do, what I would do is I'd pause this.
Yeah.
Save the recording, open a new Zoom, mm-hmm. and go again. Because it will be cut off to 40 minutes per call.
Okay. So if I end this now, it will save this recording.
Save the recording.
Yeah.
Send me a new link.
Yeah.
And then I did the exact same thing the other day, because it's, you do an upgrade, but then in COVID, everybody's calls free, and they've now decided COVID is over.
That's like Eventbrite. All of them are all, everything is just costing so much. Okay, I'll do that.
Yeah, okay. Pause that, send me a link, and I will come back in. I was also like looking at the countdown.
No, I was like, I wonder how it keeps going.
No, it's fine. We were both aware of time.
Bear with me.
I will see you in a minute.
Part one has come to an end, sadly. I have a feeling these episodes will prove popular, not only because, as Charlotte mentions, we're emotional beings who often prioritise personal development, but also we often love a little nose, and I think people will be curious to the dynamics, themes and insights of our conversations. That being said, stay tuned for part two by subscribing and downloading the next episode.